1975, I understand, while you were still working for the Australian Council for Overseas Aid, you attended a conference.
Yes, it was obviously International Women's Year. There was the first International Women's Year or International Women's Conference was held in Mexico, and this was going to be a really big deal. There was side by side with the official government forum, there was a big forum on for non-government organisations. And the Council for Overseas Aid decided that they would like to be represented there, and they asked me to represent them, which was a great honour, a great challenge for me. I never travelled overseas officially on any business or represented anybody. But nevertheless, I went off with a lot of other women. We had a very good, we travelled together. Through San Francisco and then down into Mexico, and spent a week at this huge non-government forum where there was a lot of fire and a lot of passion. And I came across women who from many, many different countries. I heard about the stories of what was going on in their homelands. We shared stories. We laughed together. We drank together. It was a great experience.
Did you speak at the conference? Or?
No, I didn't speak at the conference. I did have to write a fairly substantial report on it when I came back. And obviously I had learned a lot, so it was a very good exercise for me to do that. But it was a great coming together of thousands of women, thousands and thousands of women. And every evening or quite regularly during the conference, we would meet up with the official delegation, so we would know what was going on at the government conference. So I remember Susan Ryan, who was leading our government. I think no, Susan Ryan was part of the delegation, as was Germaine Greer. And so I remember those very strong women meeting with us and inspiring us and telling us what was going on. And that was a great learning curve for me.
What was your, what, how did you see your role in attending the conference?
I saw my, well, I think I saw my role very much as being there to learn. That's what ACFOA had told me to do, to go and listen, to hear what other people were saying, particularly women from developing countries. And that's what I did. I tried to absorb as much as I possibly could, took a lot of notes so that I could write a substantial report when I got back and share that knowledge around.
What were the main sort of topics that came up?
Oh, it's hard to remember. It was about, well, it was about the gender divide. It was about the sorts of struggles that women were having. But at the same time, I think I became very much aware that women in liberation movements, such as in South Africa, were also going to be very loyal to their men. So they weren't there to talk about the gender divide as much as the problems that their people had in becoming free enough to sort out those issues. So, very much for me, the message from many of the Third World women was development first, equalities. Not second, but then we will get equality because we need to have enough food, we need to have enough money to be able to pay attention to these issues.
Was this consistent with the kind of views that had come out of your discussions earlier on in the working for the council? I mean, you mentioned that there was a strong interest in equality and in development. Was this consistent with that, or
It
was not?
wasn't inconsistent, I think. I mean, because if at the same time women were saying, but you have to understand our cultures if you're going to provide aid, that has to be culturally appropriate. So, no, there's not a conflict, but it's a different way of looking at it and being aware that in giving aid, you must also look at the culture, what's happening in the country itself. So within the culture, what is the place of women? What is the place of men? And there is a big theme about educating women, you educate the family. So there was a lot of emphasis on education, of course, for both partners, but particularly for women, because women will teach their children to read and to write and to become educated.
Did the council, as a result of your attendance at that conference and what happened at the conference, change its approach, do you think, in any way?
I think the members of the council, some of the members of the council were changing their approach because they realised that they needed to, because of the discussions that had taken place through International Women's Year. And I think they were setting the tone for others to follow. So it wasn't so much the council itself, because that was a peak body that was set up to represent interest of government. But they did start to take up, I think, the issue of gender to government, so that that could be dealt with within the aid, official aid program.
This was in the early part of 75?
Oh, this was, I think it was probably mid-75 that the conference was on, mid to late. So there was a lot of action that flowed on from that in terms of of looking at what the agencies were doing.
And you stayed on with the council till 1977?
Yes, I stayed on till 1977.
Did your work change at all after, in a sense, your approach to it or anything changed after when you came back from that conference?
I think I came back with a renewed energy and a greater sense of self-confidence than I'd had before. I was certainly stronger in my feminism. And at the same time, the education unit was changing as well, because Brendan O'Dwyer, who was the first director, and who'd been very influential with me, had come into conflict with the governing board and had left. And so there was a change in the management of the unit, and the unit was coming under increasing scrutiny because we were generally seen to be rather radical and left-wing, and this was not altogether a good thing, particularly as governments was changing. So the job was changing. There was more pressure there, but also I'd been there for, by 1977, I'd been there for 5 years. So I wasn't consciously looking for a job, but I had, looking back, I can see that I was possibly in a bit of a rut, and was open to new opportunities. And so when they came knocking, I took them.
When you say knocking, can you how it came about that you joined the National Secretariat of ALP, as I understand it, in 1977?
Yes. In 1975, I had joined the Labour Party, and that was partly because I recognised the need to give expression to my increasing commitment to a party that stood for the sort of social justice ideals that were firming up in my mind, and also because it seemed to me that they were far more sympathetic to feminism. I mean, obviously, the Labour Party is a very male-dominated organisation, but there were a lot of very strong women in the Labour Party at that time. So I joined and had become fairly active in my local branch. But while working for ACFAR, one of the other staff there was a lady called Jill Wan, who was married to Bob Wan. Bob, from 1972 to 75, was the member for Eden Monaro, the Labour member for Eden Monaro, and a great campaigner on some women's issues, particularly abortion law reform. Jill and I had become quite great friends, and through Jill I'd become friends with her family, with Bob and the family as well. Bob, after he lost his seat in 1975, went to work for the National Secretariat of the Labour Party. The National Secretary at that stage was David Coombe. In 1977, Bob realised that David needed a good executive assistant, somebody who would organise him and perhaps enable him to harness the considerable talents he had. And he suggested to me that I come and talk to, that I would be a good person to do this, and that I should come and talk to David Coombe, which I did, and David almost immediately offered me a job. And while in some ways it was a little bit going downhill in terms of status for me, it seemed to me to be a good opportunity to well, to be part of the Labor Party team at the national level and to see politics as I wanted to see it. And so I took that job. Now, that was fairly tough at the start because I joined in the middle of the 1977 election campaign, which was a fairly disastrous campaign. But looking back on it, it was actually a really good time to start because I was thrown straight into the hurly-burly. I had to support David Coombe, who was a brilliant man and who I'll still say is a brilliant man, great man. I learned a lot from him. And I worked for the Labor Party for 10 years, and during that time it grew from, I guess, being down in a trough in 1977 to being one of the most successful political machines there was.
Mm.
From 1983 onwards we were in government. So mm. I saw the whole organisation change.
Mm. So this work... So going back to the perhaps little one step back for a minute, you joined the Labor Party, you say, before 1975.
I think it was in 1975.
Okay.
I think it was either late 74 or 75, and I'd have to confess that part of the motivation was my marriage had just broken up. And my husband had been very uncomfortable and made life difficult about me being politically active. So this was in one sense an act of defiance.
Mm.
So as well as a real statement of this is where my political commitment mm. is going to be.
At the same time, you also mentioned that where you had been with the Overseas Aid Council, the policies or work at the level there had become perhaps a bit, you mentioned left, gone, veered a bit
we,
to the left.
We were seen to be going too far to the left, yes.
So that was, and was that influencing your decision to...
No, not at all.
Not to leave? Or?
Not at all. I saw myself as a bit of a radical at that stage. So, no, it didn't.
Going back to the beginning with the National Secretariat of the ALP, where was that? Where was that based?
That was in John Curtin House in Barton. That was a house that had been put up under David's guidance. David had seen that the party needed to have its own property, and not to be paying rent, and had got a grant of land from the government. And had found finance to put the building up, and so the secretariat was on the top floor of that building, and the rest of it was leased out mainly to the public service.
What was the? Can you describe the? What was the structure of the secretariat when you joined?
Okay, it was a fairly small staff. There was David, who was the national secretary, and there was Ken Bennett, who was the assistant national secretary. There was also a fundraiser who was a sort of contractor. And then there were several administrative staff, and I think that was it when I first joined. Now, obviously, I joined in the middle of the campaign and there was all sorts of other people were there playing roles, both as volunteers or people who'd been paid to come in on a temporary basis.
Mm. So what was your role as you were executive assistant? What was your
Well, it was very much as I carved it out. It started out, I think David really basically needed a secretary, somebody who would organise him, and I did that. But I managed to he actually encouraged me to expand that role out after the 77 election campaign. Which came up with a very disastrous result. The party executive decided to establish a committee of inquiry into why we had lost so badly and what we needed to do in order to rebuild. And that committee was chaired notionally by Bob Hawke and Bill Hayden as leader of the party, who was then leader of the party, and Bob Hawke was obviously the leader of the trade union movement. But the people they delegated most of the work to do were Neil Blewett and John Button. And David asked me if I would provide the committee with all the administrative support they needed. So I went off and I worked quite closely with Neil Blewett and John Button and their staff to get this thing established and to call for submissions. And I provided all the secretariat support for that committee of inquiry, which was a great experience because I worked with two very great men in Neil Blewett and John Button, a lot of help from John Button's staff, Jeff Evans. And I got to know a lot about the Labor Party through that process.
And this, how long did this work take? Did you travel around the country to sort of take evidence? Or?
No, I didn't. Neil Blewett and John Button and the committee travelled round, but I stayed put. I summarised each one of the submissions, and I think there were about 300 of them. So I summarised each one. I gave a comment to each of the members of the committee. I worked with the committee, and there were two very good women on that committee, Fran, oh gosh, I've forgotten her name, and Anne Foreman. And they took up the women's issues on that committee. And we wrote a report, I think, in 1978 or 79 that Neil mostly wrote and presented that to the party. And the reception to that was mixed, as I'm having trouble remembering it in detail. But some of the recommendations were taken up.
What actually, Dan, out of interest, can you remember what the conclusions they drew? Why did Labor lose so disastrously?
I'm having trouble remembering. I'd need to go back to the report, which I don't think I've got. But it was about, I think the recommendations were about keeping the base of the party broad, about needing to go out and talk to the experts in the field to develop policy, to develop the membership, and to have a truly national machine. And as a result of that inquiry, I think David was able to find funds to expand the staff at the National Secretariat, so he brought on a communications director. He established a small research unit, and we were able to put a lot more effort into developing policy.
Were you to what extent were you involved in that kind of work?
Well, in that I was actually, in that role, I actually sat in David's office so I could talk to him all the time and sit on the meetings he had. And generally I would talk to David about the ideas and the things he wanted to talk to me about. And we had lots of good discussions and worked very, very closely together. It was a great relationship.
So you were a kind of sounding board for him, do you think?
I guess in a way, but I wasn't the only sounding board. He was probably more comfortable with some of the men around him than me. But he did seem to trust my judgment and sound things out with me, yeah.
You said the size of the secretariat expanded. Mm. Seems to have expanded quite dramatically after the as a consequence of this report. From being what... a handful of members in when you joined. To what sort of what?
I guess there were about 10 to 15 staff at any one time. Yes, it was mostly in the communications area that we expanded and in the research area, research stroke policy area that we expanded.
And your role was still being that of being an executive assistant to David Coombe?
It was, but I also, I'm trying to remember now, sorry. In the late 70s and early 80s, there was talk of an affirmative action program for women in the party. And obviously I became a bit involved in discussions about that. And people like Susan Ryan encouraged me to be part of that debate. And eventually, when we were expanding the secretariat, there was also, I should have mentioned this earlier, there were positions of national organisers created. Now, that was actually as a result of David's leaving and Bob McMullen taking over. Bob did a bit of a restructure in the secretariat. and created three positions for national organisers. These were people who would actually be able to organise election campaigns, conferences, whatever needed to be organised. And the party decided that it should reserve one of those places for a female. And I was encouraged to apply for that job and was given it in 1983.
Why do you think they've... Was this part of an affirmative action type of program?
This was part of an affirmative action program, yes.
But still only one of three?
Only one of three, but that was a big achievement. All the rest of the senior people in the secretariat were blokes. So yes, it was quite an achievement to get that. We had one other female official at state level at that stage. So I was the first female national official.
According to the notes, you were elected.
Mm. Yes, it was. Well, the position was appointed by the national executive, so a vote had to be taken, and there was one other candidate, and so there was a vote was taken.
And that was the first time that had happened.
Yes.
And was there an election for the men?
Yes. Yes.
And but not by the national executive, not by the national. Yes, not by the conference.
Not by the conference. No, this was a national executive matter.
And so this was in 1983. Then you'd had been 6 years working in the secretariat.
Yes, already. Yes, yes.
And you said the roles of coming to the national organisers. Can you describe what exactly was expected of the people in those roles? Because I understand, if I understood it, they were new positions.
Obviously, we had to do some of the tasks we had to do were new, but a lot of them were jobs that would previously have been done elsewhere in the secretariat. So the three of us had to take a far more active role in the marginal seat campaigns than we had previously. Previously, marginal seat campaigns, or the campaigns in the marginal seats, had been very much the province of the state secretaries. Now, when the national organisers were appointed, I had suggested to Bob that we needed to take far more active role in knowing what was going on in the marginal seats far, far before an election campaign. We needed to be making sure that those seats were having good candidates and that the candidates were resourced to do the job they needed to do and that they had the resources to do the job. And so we put it to a state secretary's forum that we should take on this role, and obviously we would work very closely with the states, etc., etc. And they agreed after some humming and haring. And so the three organisers divided up the country between us and took on different states, and I think I took on the Northern Territory, South Australia. I had Tasmania at one stage. I think I might have had Victoria. So we each took a slab of the country to oversee the marginal seat campaigns from. And that was the start of the serious work that the parties are doing in marginal seats today.
A bit of Labor Party history in terms of that. I mean, it is as a federal party, and the states have always had their own organisations. Mm.
Yes, it very much was a federation at certainly when I joined, and David's role. The National Secretary's role was a somewhat tenuous one in that the states were very, very territorial, and they didn't really they saw their job basically as running state election and getting state governments organised, and they hadn't paid too much attention to the national parliament. And when David came in, he started to change that balance. Now, there was a lot of resistance to that. But he did make a lot of progress, and I think the party that built up in the 1970s and the 1980s is a result of the work he did.
How did the changes come about that the state parties, in to a degree at least, gave the power, handed over some of their powers?
I think once the Whitlam government lost office, the states realised that they did need to do something about the federal parliament, I guess they started to take a broader view that they needed to have a national party. So, and I think that the review that Blewett and Button did was very important in opening people's eyes to the importance of a federal government and the ways that the party needed to adjust in order to win government and to be able to keep government.
That's an interesting comment, that in a sense, is there one could infer that the Labour Party mid-70s at least, really did have little interest in federal government? Surely
I think their priority was not federal government, is perhaps the way I should frame it. So that their priority was state government and the rewards that they saw going with state government. But their priorities changed during the mid to late 70s and the 80s. They saw that national government was a prize that they needed to attend to, and that in order to get and to keep federal government, they needed to change the way they were doing business somewhat.
How did that change come about? Were there resolutions passed at national conferences, or was this a...
It was a long process. So there were things that happened, like the Queensland Party was a dreadful mess. I hate to say the word, but probably a bit corrupt. It was inefficient. So the National Executive decided to intervene in the Queensland branch. And that was very contentious. That was very unpleasant. It resulted in a court case, but the court case came down with the finding that the federal party had the power to do this. And so that changed the way that the state parties were looking at the federal party. Mm. It actually clarified who had power and in what circumstances. So that was a very, very significant move. Can you repeat the question, Edward?
I've almost forgotten myself now. There was coming back to, in a sense, the national organisers, when your role was one of those. How you mentioned one of the marginal seats and the need to have strong candidates in marginal seats. How were you, as a national organiser, able to influence the selection of candidates by state parties for the?
We couldn't directly influence, but we could keep an eye on things, and we could talk to the state secretaries, we could talk to the local party officials, but we had no direct influence on the pre-selection, because a lot of that's done by rank and file, and quite rightly so. But we could perhaps keep an eye out for the good candidates and encourage them. I certainly encouraged women to stand for pre-selection. So it was really about being in there and keeping the party's consciousness of the importance of the good candidate. But our role was really more about supporting and reinforcing the candidate once they were there.
So the selection, once the party had selected a candidate, that's where your role as national organiser came in, to ensure they had adequate resources.
Yes. And that they had the skills, so that we could step in and say if they were not comfortable with their communication skills, perhaps we could provide them with some media training or et cetera, et cetera.
Did you do that a lot?
We went round and visited each of the marginal seats, talked to the campaigns, talked to the campaign managers, said, what are you doing? What's your campaign plan? So we did almost an audit of how they were going. And introduced ourselves so that they knew that they could ring us in the national office in the event that they needed some help.
So, but then you had no, but you weren't directly involved with the campaigns as such, were you?
From time to time, yes, particularly in a by-election. I think one of my very first jobs after being elected as an organiser was to go and jointly be campaign manager for the seat of Wannon when Malcolm Fraser resigned. I mean, a thankless task, but not a bad one to cut your teeth on when you're a very junior, a new national organiser. Mm. So I spent 3 weeks out in the electorate there working with the local party machine and helping to run the election campaign out there. And then that was followed very quickly by another by-election in one of the Melbourne seats where I think Heather O'Connor was a candidate. I'd have to check this, but I think she was running against Michael Waldridge, and that's when Michael Waldridge was elected to Parliament. But that was a very marginal seat. And then shortly after that, I had to go up to the Northern Territory where they were about to have a state election. It was the first time I'd ever been to the Northern Territory. I knew nothing about it, but I had to plunge straight in.
Sounds like an enormous list of tasks for only three people, for three organisers to cover the nation and all the
Yes, it was, but we were working very closely with our state counterparts, so we didn't have sole responsibility. Mm. I think the states, it's fair to say the states still had the responsibility when we were there as in a supportive role and a role to make sure that there was no gaping holes in the campaigns.
So did that help include being able to provide funding?
There was a formula worked out nationally for election campaign funding, so where each of the states put in and then each of the states got a certain amount out, and I can't remember how that was that was worked out, but it was quite equitable, and so yes, so we didn't directly deal with the campaign financing. That was done through the national executive.
Was this role as national organiser, was that that you've now described, was that all that the national organisers did? I mean, a focus on the electorates and focus on...
Oh, no, we would do... I mean, one of my jobs was to organise the big national conferences. So I organised the national conference in 1984 and 1986, 1984 being in Canberra and 86 being in Hobart. And that's a huge job because we had every state. Labor was in government in every state in 1984 and 86, I think. And we had every state premier at the conference. We'd have many of the state ministers. We'd have we'd have the prime minister there. At any one stage. Several members of the federal ministry would be at the conference, as well, of course, as the party delegates. And, of course, we had every political journalist in the country at the conference. So it was a huge task. It took me 6 months to organise it.
And is the secretariat, the last number I heard you mentioned about 10, 12 people, and all were involved in planning for the conference?
Or? No, it was my job.
You had that as
I had an assistant. I had a half an assistant, and we did it. Obviously, as the time got closer, I involved the other two national organisers. They had specific jobs at the conference, but in terms of organising the whole thing, that was me and my assistant Glenda Johnson.
There, I said, how did you do it?
Without the use of computers. Or iPhones or iPads or any of that stuff. we just did it. Mm. We just did it.
Stepping back for one again a little bit, two still young children. How did you manage to combine the role of being a parent and what sounds like an incredibly intense job?
Yes, it was not easy. My daughter... In 1983, when I took on the job of national organiser, just before that, my daughter had left school and was going to university in Melbourne. And in fact, one of the things that happened to me just before I was elected as national organiser, when Bob Hawke suddenly took over from Bill Hayden as leader of the Labor Party in 83, just before the campaign, I was seconded onto Bob Hawke's staff to help with the campaign because everything was such a rush, and because of the change of leadership, he didn't have the staff. So I was seconded and onto his staff, and I did what is called the advance work, together with Senator Kerry Cyber from New South Wales. That involved basically travelling around the country ahead of Bob Hawke and his campaign party, just making sure that everything was in order and that the itinerary for his visit was worked out and that all the details were attended to. So checking things like microphones and venues and distance between hotel, airport and the campaign functions. So doing all that sort of thing. Tremendously exciting, because it was a great sense in the community about having Bob Hawke for Prime Minister and change of government. So during the middle of all that, my daughter left home. A friend had come to stay with the children and to look after them, and my daughter was coming down to university. And I was actually able to meet her off the plane in Melbourne because I was due to be in Melbourne on that day. So I could take her to her accommodation in Melbourne and give her a big hug because she was quite emotional at that stage. So, yeah, it took a lot of help from friends as well as the children being fairly, very self-reliant as well.
Could I ask you, when you were working these sort of hours, did the job pay overtime, for example?
No.